The following audiobooks contain AI-generated content and may contain errors. This audiobook narration presents pricing power, marginal cost, demand, and value capture. Topic introduction. Pricing is one of the most familiar decisions in business, and also one of the most misunderstood. It looks simple because it often appears as a single number. In reality, price is a strategic choice that shapes demand, profit, customer behavior, and the division of value between buyer and seller. A price can attract volume or repel it. It can protect margin or destroy it. It can signal quality, segment customers, and reveal how much market power a firm really has. In that sense, pricing is never just a bookkeeping exercise. It is a core management decision. This lecture is designed for graduate-level learners and business professionals who want a clear, rigorous way to think about pricing without getting lost in jargon. If the terms marginal cost, elasticity, or consumer surplus already sound familiar, this lecture will connect them into a practical framework. If they do not, the discussion will build them carefully from the ground up. Either way, the goal is not only to define the vocabulary, but to show why it matters when managers set prices in real markets, from industrial goods to software to consumer brands. The central tension running through the lecture is a simple one. When does a price create value? When does it merely redistribute value? And when does it actually destroy value? That question matters now because pricing is changing. Firms increasingly work with subscriptions, versioning, dynamic repricing, revenue management, and data-driven segmentation. Customers compare offers more quickly, competitors respond faster, and software makes it easier to change prices at scale. In that environment, a firm that still thinks only in terms of cost plus markup risks missing the deeper economics of the market. To understand pricing well, we have to begin with foundations. We need a working sense of cost, demand, willingness to pay, elasticity, and the gains from trade. We also need to understand why market structure matters, because a firm that takes price as given faces a very different problem from a firm that has room to shape price strategically. From there, the lecture turns to the logic of charging different prices to different buyers, whether through menus of product versions, timing, channels, quantity terms, or customer segments. Along the way, we will keep returning to the practical constraints that make pricing succeed or fail, including arbitrage, capacity, and the difficulty of aligning a pricing system with a real organization. The guiding idea is that price is both a number and a system. It is a number attached to a transaction, but it is also a way of organizing demand, protecting margins, and capturing part of the value a firm helps create. By the end of the lecture, listeners should be able to look at a pricing problem and ask the right questions. What is the relevant cost? How sensitive is demand? Where is market power present, and where is it limited? Which customers can be served differently, and how can those differences be defended? Those are the questions that turn pricing from guesswork into strategy. End of introduction. Pricing is often treated as a narrow question of what number to print on an offer or what number to enter into a system. Economically, it is much larger than that. A price affects how many units get sold, how much money arrives for each unit, and how the gains from trade get divided between buyers and sellers. That is why pricing is never just an accounting outcome. It is a choice about quantity, margin, and value capture. When a firm raises its price, it may earn more on each sale, but lose some sales altogether. When it lowers its price, it may earn less per unit, but unlock more transactions. The real problem is not to find the single highest number. It is to find the price or set of prices that aligns demand, cost, and strategy in a way that creates value and lets the firm capture part of that value. So pricing is both a revenue lever and a strategic instrument. Revenue depends on price and quantity together, not on price alone. Profit depends on revenue and cost together, and cost usually changes with output. A pricing decision, therefore, changes both sides of the economic equation at once. It changes who buys, how much they buy, and how much surplus remains with the buyer rather than the seller. A firm that treats price as a passive number copied from cost reports risks missing that broader logic. A firm that treats price strategically asks a harder question.
It asks not only what the product costs, but also how demand responds, how much value buyers perceive, and how much of that value the seller can retain without losing too much volume. To reason clearly about pricing, the cost side has to be stated carefully. The most important concept is marginal cost. Marginal cost is the change in total cost caused by producing and selling one more unit. In formal economics, marginal cost is the derivative of total cost with respect to quantity. That formal language matters because it captures the right intuition. Marginal cost is incremental. It is not the cost of the whole operation, and it is not even the average cost per unit. Marginal cost is the cost of the next unit, given the current level of output. If one more sale requires more materials, more packaging, more shipping, more payment processing, more customer support time, or any other expense that appears because the unit is added, those additions belong in marginal cost for that decision. If a cost does not change when one more unit is sold, then it is not part of marginal cost for that specific choice. This is where many pricing discussions go wrong. They confuse marginal cost with average cost.
Average cost takes total cost and spreads it across total output. It answers a different question. What does each unit bear, on average, if you allocate all costs across all units? That can be useful for budgeting, benchmarking, and long-run planning. It is not the same as the cost of producing the next unit. This distinction matters because rejecting transactions based on average cost can be economically misleading. A firm can have a high average cost due to large fixed costs or low current volume, even when the next unit has a relatively low marginal cost.
In that situation, refusing to sell when price is below average cost can mean walking away from sales that still add to overall profit by contributing something toward fixed costs. The reverse problem also exists. A sale above marginal cost is not automatically a sign of a healthy business. If, over time, revenue does not cover total cost, including fixed cost, the firm cannot remain viable. So average cost still matters for sustainability. But for decisions about producing one more unit, accepting one more order, or serving one more customer, the relevant benchmark is marginal cost.
Managers often use a closely related concept for incremental judgment, contribution margin. Contribution margin is price minus variable cost per unit. It measures how much each additional sale contributes toward covering fixed costs, and once fixed costs are covered, toward profit. This is often the first economic screen in pricing, because accounting profit can be distorted by allocation rules. Common costs, overhead, and shared infrastructure may be assigned across products in ways that are useful for financial reporting, but not very informative for incremental decisions.
A product line can look unattractive after heavy cost allocation and still have a healthy contribution on each additional sale. In that case, shutting it down or refusing incremental business can make the overall firm worse off. On the other hand, if contribution margin is negative, then each additional unit sold destroys value before any fixed cost recovery even comes into play. More volume does not fix that problem. It deepens it. That is why many operating managers look first at contribution margin for short-run pricing or acceptance decisions.
Accounting profit remains important because no firm can survive forever on positive contribution margin if fixed costs never get covered. Contribution margin usually provides the cleaner signal for incremental pricing choices. A basic distinction that also needs discipline is the difference between markup and margin. These terms are often used casually, as if they were interchangeable. They are not. Markup measures the gap between price and cost as a percentage of cost. Margin measures that same dollar gap as a percentage of price.
Because price is larger than cost on a profitable sale, the same dollar spread becomes a smaller percentage when you divide by price instead of cost. That is why a markup can sound large, even when the resulting margin is modest. This matters because pricing errors often begin as language errors. If a manager asks for a target margin and someone applies that percentage as if it were a markup, the quoted price will miss the target. Markup starts from cost. Margin starts from price. They answer different questions and should not be blended together. Once cost is clarified, the next step is demand.
Demand is the relationship between price and quantity demanded. More fully stated, it is the schedule connecting many possible prices to many possible quantities that buyers would be willing and able to purchase over a given period, holding other relevant conditions constant. One observed quantity at one price is only one point on that relationship. Demand is about the broader schedule. Underneath demand lies willingness to pay. Willingness to pay is the maximum amount a buyer would give up for a unit under the circumstances that matter at the moment.
Aggregate willingness to pay across buyers and units gives rise to the demand curve conceptually, even if the curve is never drawn. This is why pricing cannot be separated from context. Willingness to pay is not a fixed property sealed inside the product. It varies with circumstances. It changes with reference points, because buyers compare the current offer to what they expected to pay, what they paid before, or what they consider normal. It changes with urgency, because immediate need reduces the ability to search, wait, or substitute.
It changes with the availability of substitutes, because close alternatives constrain what any one seller can charge. And it changes with the broader setting in which the purchase decision is evaluated, including how costly delay feels. A pricing move, therefore, does more than shift a cursor along a demand schedule. It can change the schedule itself. Demand is not just a count of interested buyers. It is an economic expression of value under particular conditions. The next step is to measure how sensitive that demand is to changes in price. The central measure here is price elasticity of demand.
Price elasticity of demand compares the percent change in quantity demanded to the percent change in price. Because quantity usually moves opposite to price, the measure is typically negative. But in pricing work, the focus is on the size of the response rather than the negative sign. If demand is elastic, quantity demanded changes more than proportionally when price changes. Practically, that means a price increase causes a large enough volume loss that revenue falls, all else equal. If demand is inelastic, quantity changes less than proportionally.
Then, a price increase tends to raise revenue because the loss in volume is relatively small compared with the gain in price per unit. Elasticity is central to pricing strategy because it converts intuition into an operational question.
how much volume will be lost if price rises, and will the higher margin offset that loss? Elasticity also connects to the durability of pricing power. Substitutes matter because they give buyers somewhere else to go. More close substitutes usually make demand more elastic because even a small price increase can trigger switching. Necessity matters because buyers are less free to walk away from something they feel they must continue purchasing, at least in the short run. Time horizon matters because adjustment takes time. Immediately after a price change, buyers may have limited information or few alternatives. Over time, they search, compare, substitute, postpone, or redesign their behavior. Demand can look more inelastic at first and more elastic later. So elasticity is not just a statistic. It is a way of thinking about customer adjustment, competitive constraint, and how long a pricing decision stays effective.
This also shows why pricing is always tied to quantity. A seller does not choose price in a vacuum. The seller chooses a point on a demand relationship, and elasticity indicates how sharply quantity reacts around that point. Once willingness to pay, cost, and quantity are connected, the idea of gains from trade becomes clearer. A transaction creates value when the buyer values the unit more than it costs to supply that unit at the margin. If willingness to pay exceeds marginal cost, trade can generate a surplus. Price then determines how that surplus gets divided.
Consumer surplus is the difference between what buyers are willing to pay and what they actually pay. Producer surplus is the difference between the price the seller receives and the marginal cost of supplying the unit. Together, consumer surplus and producer surplus make up the gains from trade. This framework separates value creation from value capture. Value is created when exchange happens on terms where willingness to pay exceeds marginal cost. Value is captured according to where the price sits between those two benchmarks. A lower price leaves more surplus with the buyer.
A higher price transfers more of that surplus to the seller on units that still trade. That transfer is economically important, but it is not the same as total value being destroyed. Total value is lost when output falls below the efficient level. The efficient level is reached when the last unit sold is just worth its marginal cost of production. At that point, all units with value to buyers above marginal cost are traded, and no units with value below marginal cost are forced into production. If output falls short, some mutually beneficial trades do not occur.
Buyers value those units more than it costs to produce them, yet they remain unsold. The surplus that would have been created by those missing transactions goes to no one. It vanishes. That lost value is deadweight loss. Deadweight loss is therefore best understood as value destroyed by too little output relative to the efficient benchmark. This distinction matters because pricing has two different effects. One effect is distributional. Changing the price can change how surplus is divided between buyers and sellers on the units that still trade.
The other effect is allocative. If the price change reduces the number of units traded below the efficient level, society loses value through deadweight loss. That is why pricing analysis is not only about the firm's revenue. It is also about how total surplus is created, divided, and sometimes destroyed. The welfare consequences become clearer once pricing systems can both capture more producer surplus and expand output. But the starting point stays the same. Understand surplus, understand deadweight loss, and then reason about how different pricing choices affect both. With that foundation, market power can be defined precisely.
Market power, often called pricing power in business language, is the ability to charge a price above marginal cost without losing prohibitive volume.
The key phrase is without losing prohibitive volume. A seller can always announce a very high price. That alone is not evidence of market power. Market power exists only when enough buyers still choose the offer at that higher price. So market power is about the firmness of the demand facing the firm. If buyers see many close substitutes and can switch easily, the firm has little room to raise price above marginal cost.
If buyers view the offer as distinctive, necessary, or hard to replace, the firm has more room. Market power comes in degrees, and those degrees are closely tied to elasticity. The less elastic the demand facing the firm, the more pricing power the firm can sustain. The more elastic the demand, the more competition and substitution pressure pull price back toward marginal cost. Economics organizes these possibilities through stylized market structures. Real markets are messier, but the categories still help because each one implies a different pricing logic.
In perfect competition, each firm is so small relative to the market, and its product is so undifferentiated relative to rivals, that it takes market price as given. The firm is a price taker. It does not choose price in any meaningful sense. It chooses output at the prevailing market price. In that setting, the decision is straightforward. If the market price is above the marginal cost of producing the next unit, producing that unit adds more revenue than cost, so producing it increases profit. If the market price is below marginal cost, producing that unit reduces profit. The firm therefore expands output until price equals marginal cost.
This competitive condition aligns the value of the last unit sold, as reflected in market price, with the cost of supplying that unit at the margin. Once you move away from perfect competition, the firm no longer treats price as fixed. It faces a downward sloping demand relationship. This includes monopolistic competition and monopoly, with different strengths of pricing power. Here, the trade-off between margin and volume becomes central. A higher price earns more on each unit, but reduces quantity demanded. A lower price expands quantity, but compresses the amount captured per unit.
In that setting, the relevant comparison is not price against marginal cost directly. The firm compares marginal revenue against marginal cost. Marginal revenue is the extra revenue generated by selling one more unit. Profit-maximizing firms expand output as long as marginal revenue exceeds marginal cost, and they contract output when marginal revenue falls below marginal cost. The profit-maximizing quantity is where marginal revenue equals marginal cost. Only after determining that quantity does the firm look back to the demand relationship to identify the price buyers are willing to pay for that quantity.
This sequence matters because imperfect competition changes the relationship between price and marginal revenue. When demand slopes downward, marginal revenue lies below price. To sell one more unit, the firm typically has to lower price, and that lower price affects earlier units as well. As a result, the extra revenue from the next unit is less than the price attached to that unit. That wedge between price and marginal cost is the economic expression of market power. It is also the root of deadweight loss, because restricted output means some trades that would have been efficient do not occur.
Monopolistic competition describes many firms selling differentiated offers. Each firm has some pricing power because its product is not a perfect substitute for every rival's product. Still, substitutes limit that power. The firm follows the same basic rule. It chooses the quantity where marginal revenue equals marginal cost, then charges the price supported by demand at that quantity. Price typically exceeds marginal cost, but the gap is constrained by competition from differentiated alternatives. Monopoly applies the same optimization logic in a more concentrated setting. The monopolist faces the market demand relationship directly. Because it is the sole seller within the relevant market definition, it usually has more freedom to restrict quantity and set price above marginal cost. But the governing rule remains: choose quantity where marginal revenue equals marginal cost, then set price from demand. A useful way to unify the story is to see perfect competition as a special case. In perfect competition, a firm can sell an additional unit at the market price without having to lower the price on earlier units. That means marginal revenue equals price.
When marginal revenue equals price, the general condition, marginal revenue equals marginal cost, collapses into the familiar condition, price equals marginal cost. At this stage, the core vocabulary of pricing is in place. Marginal cost describes the next unit's cost, while average cost describes how the total cost burden is spread across units. Contribution margin shows what each sale adds after variable cost. Markup and margin describe different percentages built from the same price-cost spread.
Demand links price and quantity, and willingness to pay explains why the relationship exists and why it shifts with reference points, urgency, and substitutes. Elasticity shows how sharply quantity responds to price, and that sensitivity determines whether revenue expands or contracts. Consumer surplus and producer surplus describe the gains from trade, while deadweight loss names the value that disappears when output stays below the efficient level.
Market power is the ability to charge above marginal cost without losing too much volume, and the logic of pricing changes as one moves from perfect competition to monopolistic competition to monopoly. With those foundations in place, the next question is what happens when buyers are not all the same. A single uniform price is often a blunt instrument. If buyers differ in willingness to pay, urgency, flexibility, or access to substitutes, one price forces a compromise. Set it too high, and some buyers who value the offer above marginal cost are excluded.
Set it too low, and other buyers receive the product at a price they would have been willing to pay more easily.
Price discrimination is the broad economic term for trying to improve on that compromise. In economics, the term is descriptive rather than moral. It means charging different prices for the same or very similar economic value across buyers, segments, channels, locations, or times of purchase. The aim is segmentation. The seller tries to align price more closely with willingness to pay or with the elasticity of different groups so that it captures more of the value created and, in some cases, makes more trades possible.
The theoretical extreme is first-degree price discrimination. In that case, each buyer, or even each unit sold to that buyer, is priced at the buyer's full willingness to pay. The seller does not settle for one posted number. It tries to trace demand buyer by buyer. Relative to a single monopoly price, the effect is striking. Consumer surplus largely disappears because the gap between willingness to pay and transaction price is captured by the seller.
At the same time, output moves toward the efficient level, because units that would have been lost under one high, uniform price can now be sold at lower individualized prices, as long as those prices still cover marginal cost. In the textbook limit, every unit whose value to some buyer exceeds marginal cost is sold, and deadweight loss falls, even as surplus shifts sharply toward the producer. That benchmark is useful precisely because it is rarely achieved in pure form. A firm usually does not know each person's exact reservation price. It may observe patterns, probabilities, and averages, but not the exact ceiling for every transaction.
Even if that information were available, customizing a different offer for every buyer can be administratively costly. And even a carefully targeted low price can unravel if resale is easy.
A buyer who receives a low price can buy and resell to someone facing a higher price, collapsing the segmentation. For those reasons, first-degree discrimination is better treated as a limiting case than as an everyday business model. Real markets rely much more on second-degree price discrimination. The key difference is that the seller does not need to know exactly who each buyer is in advance. Instead, it offers a menu and lets buyers sort themselves.
Different versions, quantities, or contract terms carry different prices, and the buyer reveals something about willingness to pay by choosing among them. Versioning is the clearest example. A stripped-down offer sits at one price, a richer offer at another, and a premium offer above both. Quantity discounts use the same principle. Buyers who need more units or who value convenience more highly choose larger packages or commit to higher volumes and receive a lower price per unit. Quality ladders work the same way, by placing features, performance, service, or convenience on ascending steps. The craft behind that menu is subtle.
The low price option has to be attractive enough to bring in price-sensitive buyers who would otherwise leave the market. At the same time, it has to be limited enough that higher-value buyers do not all trade down into it. If the entry tier is too generous, the seller gives away revenue from customers who would have paid more. If the premium tier offers too little, it looks like an empty markup and fails to pull high-value demand upward. Second-degree discrimination therefore depends on careful differences in features, quality, convenience, quantity, or contractual flexibility. Software markets make that logic especially visible.
A firm can begin with one underlying product and then build a pricing ladder around it. One plan may limit seats, cap storage, restrict integrations, or exclude advanced analytics. Another may add security controls, collaboration tools, audit features, administrative access, or priority support. Add-ons create another layer of separation. A buyer that needs only the core function can pay less. A buyer that needs more users, more automation, or more sophisticated features pays more. Seat-based pricing, feature limits, usage thresholds, and optional modules all serve the same purpose.
They let customers disclose, through their own choices, whether they are light users, growing teams, or complex accounts with high willingness to pay. Bundling extends the same logic in a different direction. Instead of pricing each component separately, the seller combines multiple products or services and offers them for one package price, often below the sum of the standalone prices. When the bundle is the only way to buy, the arrangement is pure bundling. When buyers can either purchase the item separately or buy the package, it is mixed bundling. That distinction matters. Pure bundling forces the combined purchase. Mixed bundling preserves choice while still steering many buyers toward the package. Both can increase revenue per transaction, often called average order value, because more of the seller's portfolio is sold at once. Bundling also works because buyers do not all value the same components in the same way. One buyer cares most about one feature, another about a different one. The package smooths those differences and can make the total offer attractive to a broader range of customers than separate pricing would. There is also a behavioral side. One bundle price can feel less aversive than a series of separate charges.
The buyer evaluates the package as a whole rather than confronting repeated payment decisions. That can reduce the pain of paying and make acceptance easier. Related mechanisms separate buyers not only across versions, but across time. Freemium uses a zero price or very low price entry point to widen adoption, then relies on limits, advanced features, or workflow dependence to convert the heaviest or highest value users into paid plans.
Subscription pricing charges for continuing access rather than for one isolated purchase. That can stabilize revenue for the seller, but it also sorts customers by expected duration and commitment.
Buyers who anticipate repeated use accept the subscription. Buyers with occasional needs may not. Usage-based billing takes another route by tying payment to actual consumption. A light user pays relatively little. A heavy user pays much more because usage rises over time. Two-part tariffs combine these ideas. They set an access fee, or base charge, and then add a separate per-use price. A software service with a subscription plus overage charges follows this pattern. Across all of these systems, the core idea is the same. The seller does not need complete information at the first moment of contact.
It allows behavior over time to reveal which customers generate little value, which generate moderate value, and which generate a great deal. In that sense, these methods are practical approximations to the first-degree ideal, but they reach it through self-selection rather than through perfect information. The third classic form is third-degree price discrimination. Here, the seller charges different prices to segments that are observable before the transaction is completed. Those segments may be customer groups, channels, locations, or purchase times. The theory is direct.
If one segment has less elastic demand, it can sustain a higher markup. If another segment is more price-sensitive, a lower price may attract sales that a high uniform price would miss. Unlike second-degree discrimination, which invites buyers to sort themselves through a menu, third-degree discrimination works by attaching different prices to recognizable categories. Airlines provide the standard illustration because they face fixed capacity, strong variation in demand over time, and clear differences in traveler flexibility.
Business travelers often book later, travel on specific dates, and value schedule convenience more highly than fare savings. Leisure travelers are usually more flexible and more price sensitive. A single price would either leave many leisure seats unsold or give business travelers a substantial bargain. Airlines respond with fare fences. An advance purchase requirement, for example, makes cheaper tickets available mainly to people who can plan ahead. Non-refundable tickets attach restrictions that flexible leisure travelers may tolerate, but urgent business travelers often dislike.
The seat on the aircraft is physically similar, but the terms around the purchase differ, and those terms help sort buyers into different price bands. That example leads directly to revenue management. In industries with hard-to-expand capacity, the seller does not only choose a price, it also decides how much inventory to make available at different prices as time passes. The airline asks how many seats to release at lower fares, how many to protect for later demand, and how to revise those decisions as bookings unfold.
Demand forecasting matters because the seller is always comparing a certain sale now with the possibility of a better sale later. Inventory matters because every discounted unit sold today may displace a high-value sale tomorrow. Time-varying willingness to pay matters because the people shopping early under flexible conditions are often not the same as the people who arrive late under urgent conditions. Dynamic pricing is the broader and faster-moving relative of revenue management. Instead of holding prices fixed for long periods, the seller updates them as conditions change. Demand may strengthen or weaken.
Competitors may cut or raise their prices. Inventory may tighten. Observable customer characteristics may differ from one transaction to the next. When those inputs change, the price can change as well. Sometimes the update is slow and rule-based. Sometimes it occurs in near real time. The economic rationale remains the same. If willingness to pay is not constant, and if capacity or competition is shifting, one static price can be badly misaligned with the market.
Two specialized cases sharpen that logic. Peak load pricing applies when capacity is constrained at certain times, but underused at others.
Higher peak prices ration scarce capacity and encourage some buyers to shift to off-peak periods. Lower off-peak prices help sell capacity that would otherwise go unused. The goal is not merely extraction. It is also allocation across time, when the value of an extra unit depends on whether the system is crowded. Ramsey pricing addresses a different problem. Some firms or networks face large fixed costs that must be recovered even when marginal cost is low. A uniform markup can push too many price-sensitive buyers out of the market.
The Ramsey logic, therefore, places higher markups where demand is less elastic and lower markups where demand is more elastic, so that fixed costs are recovered with less distortion than a one-size-fits-all markup would create. In both cases, elasticity remains the organizing principle. In consumer brands and retail, the same reasoning often appears in forms that feel less technical but are economically familiar. High-low pricing sets a relatively high regular price and then uses promotions, coupons, or temporary markdowns again and again.
That pattern separates shoppers who are willing to search, wait, compare, or stock up from shoppers who buy for convenience and pay the regular price. Everyday low pricing moves in the opposite direction. It keeps the regular price lower and more stable, with fewer dramatic promotions. This reduces the opportunity to sort deal seekers from convenience buyers through temporary discounts. But it can build trust, simplify communication, and reduce the noise created by constant markdown cycles. Neither approach is universally superior. Each fits a different mix of buyer behavior, brand position, and operational discipline.
Retailers and brands also work through perception. Charm pricing places an offer just below a round number. Anchor effects arise when a higher reference price, a premium version, or a stated regular price makes the target offer seem more reasonable. These tactics are not always forms of price discrimination in the narrow textbook sense, but they matter for segmentation and value capture, because willingness to pay is partly comparative. The reference point changes the buyer's internal benchmark. A premium item can make the middle item feel prudent. A posted regular price can make the sale price feel like a gain.
Entry strategy adds another layer to the same economic problem. Penetration pricing and price skimming are opposite ways to enter or scale a market. Penetration pricing begins with a low introductory price. It is built around getting broad adoption early and making the offer attractive to more price-sensitive buyers from the start. Price skimming begins with a high initial price. It targets buyers with strong early willingness to pay and captures more surplus from them before the price is lowered. One strategy reaches broadly at a low opening price. The other begins narrowly at a high opening price.
In both cases, the seller is making a judgment about how willingness to pay is distributed over time and how quickly different segments should be served. Every one of these strategies depends on one stubborn practical problem. Segments must remain at least partially separated. Arbitrage is the force that tries to erase that separation. If a low-price buyer can easily resell to a high-price buyer, the seller loses its ability to maintain different prices. The low segment becomes an indirect supply source for the high segment. Sometimes arbitrage is literal resale of the product.
Sometimes it is functional arbitrage, such as buying through a cheaper channel, contract, or region, and then using the product where a higher price would otherwise apply. Once that becomes easy, the market pushes back toward a single effective price. That is why successful segmentation usually includes anti-arbitrage tools.
Non-transferable licenses tie the right to use the product to a named account or organization. Channel controls limit who can buy through which route and under what terms. Geographic restrictions keep region-specific prices from leaking freely across borders.
Feature limits prevent the low-price version from being a perfect substitute for the high-price version. Packaging differences can make the discount offer less useful outside its intended segment. Resale policies, where they can be enforced, try to block unauthorized redistribution. These tools are not side details. They are central to the economics of discrimination. A low-price offer protects high-price margins only if it is fenced off from buyers who would otherwise use it as a loophole. With all of that in view, the welfare trade-off becomes clearer. Price discrimination is not one thing. It is a family of mechanisms, and the result depends on how the mechanism changes output, as well as how it redistributes surplus. Sometimes, discrimination expands access. A lower price to a more elastic segment brings in buyers who would have been excluded under a uniform price, so output rises and deadweight loss falls. Sometimes the main effect is transfer. Buyers who would have purchased anyway pay more, and producer surplus rises mainly at the expense of consumer surplus.
Sometimes the seller mostly divides the market more finely, matching prices to differences in timing, flexibility, quantity, or service without dramatically changing total output. The same label, therefore, covers very different outcomes. That is why serious pricing analysis cannot stop at the observation that different buyers pay different amounts. The more important questions are, which buyers are served? Which trades are newly created? How much surplus is transferred? And what mechanisms are required to keep the architecture intact? Price, at this level, is no longer just a number.
It is a system of menus, fences, bundles, thresholds, channels, and timing rules built around differences in elasticity and willingness to pay. The next question is not whether a seller can charge different prices in theory. It is which mechanism fits the product, the market, and the firm's own operating discipline. Once pricing is understood as a choice about demand, cost, and surplus, the longer historical arc becomes easier to see. The older model begins with uniform posted prices and cost-plus rules. A firm observes its costs, adds a target markup, and publishes one price for most buyers.
That approach fits a world where changing prices is slow, where transaction data is limited, and where sales channels need simple rules. It also fits organizations that want prices to look objective, because a cost sheet and a standard markup are easier to explain internally than a claim about willingness to pay. Yet cost plus starts from the wrong end of the economic problem. It asks what price covers cost plus a return, rather than what demand will bear, how elastic the buyer base is, and what substitute offers constrain the seller.
When that sequence is reversed, the firm can underprice strong demand, overprice weak demand, and confuse accounting comfort with economic logic. Cost plus can still be rational in certain environments. Costs are visible. Demand is not. A simple markup also travels easily across sales teams, distributors, geographies, and product lines. In procurement settings, regulated settings, and businesses with limited differentiation or low pricing power, that simplicity can be valuable. The critique is not that cost plus is always irrational.
The critique is that, by itself, it ignores willingness to pay and elasticity, which determine whether the price actually works in the market. Demand-led pricing reverses the sequence. It begins with customers rather than the ledger. It asks who values the offer, what alternatives they compare it with, how urgent the need is,
and how quantity changes as price changes. Only after that mapping does the firm ask what price architecture can capture value while covering cost and fitting the firm's strategy. Demand-led pricing does not ignore cost. It refuses to let cost define value.
A product may be expensive to produce and still fail to command a high price when substitutes are abundant. Another product may have low marginal cost and still support a high price when demand is inelastic, the offer is distinctive, or timing matters. That is why the modern shift in pricing is not only a move from one formula to another, it is a move from backward-looking allocation toward forward-looking optimization. Price is no longer just a list printed once and defended for a season. In many industries, it becomes a system, revised as demand, capacity, competition, and customer behavior change.
Revenue management makes this shift visible. A seat on a flight and a room for a specific night are perishable. If a unit goes unsold, the opportunity disappears. That pushes the seller to ask not only what price seems reasonable, but which units to sell now, which to protect for later demand, and how booking timing reveals elasticity. In e-commerce, the same logic often extends because price changes are cheap to implement and market feedback arrives quickly. Platform businesses add a further layer because the firm may not be setting one price for one product.
It may be setting different charges across groups whose demand affects one another. Algorithmic repricing pushes the idea further. The operating question becomes continuous. Given current demand signals, current inventory, current competitor behavior, current channel constraints, and current customer mix, what price or menu should apply now? This does not imply that every firm should chase constant motion. The deeper point is that the underlying problem increasingly looks like continuous optimization rather than a one-time list price decision. That shift changes managerial discipline.
In a cost-plus mindset, price often appears late, after product design, budgeting, and cost allocation are largely complete. In a stronger economic sequence, pricing starts earlier and guides more of the commercial design. A defensible sequence starts with demand. Starting with cost tends to tempt firms to treat demand as a residual question, as if the market will accept whatever number emerges from accounting. Starting with demand forces a clearer view of who buys, who does not, what trade-offs buyers are making, and what would cause them to switch, delay, reduce usage, or upgrade. Willingness to pay matters, but so does why it differs.
Some buyers care about speed. Some care about reliability. Some care about status. Some care almost entirely about price. Those differences are the raw material of strategy. Only after demand is mapped does the firm estimate marginal cost and contribution margin, because that second step blocks a common mistake. A firm can discover strong willingness to pay and still destroy value if the offer is costly to serve at the margin. Conversely, a firm can reject a potentially good transaction because average cost allocation makes it look worse on paper than it is for incremental decisions. Marginal cost remains the benchmark for the next unit.
Contribution margin remains the cleaner screen for short-run pricing decisions. In practice, estimating marginal cost means looking beyond factory expense to the costs that rise when one more unit is sold. That can include fulfillment, returns, payment processing, commissions, support, and service obligations. In digital businesses, the marginal cost of the core product can be low, but support, cloud usage, fraud risk, and acquisition spending can still matter. In physical channels, shipping, handling, and retailer allowances may be as important as the production cost itself.
Even with demand-led pricing,
The price has to survive this incremental test. If incremental sales do not produce positive contribution, volume does not rescue the business. It deepens the problem. After demand and marginal economics are clear, the next step is elasticity and pricing power. This is where strategy has to become empirical. Many firms speak as if they have pricing power, when what they really have is hope. The serious test is how buyers actually respond. Historical transaction data can help, but it often contains confounding influences. Promotions coincide with holidays. Price changes occur alongside product changes.
Competitors react. Sales teams discount selectively. The cleaner path increasingly uses experimentation and controlled changes, such as pricing tests that compare comparable customer groups and observe revealed behavior rather than stated intention. Experimentation is valuable for more than finding a single best price. It supports estimates of elasticity and segment response, including upgrade behavior, churn risk, and the points where demand bends sharply rather than smoothly.
It also helps reveal whether a premium tier truly attracts high-value buyers, whether a lower entry price expands the market in a durable way, and whether a promotional tactic creates incremental demand or mainly trains customers to wait. Better analytics deepen this learning, but they do not replace managerial judgment. Cohort analysis can show how different groups respond over time. Retention data can reveal whether introductory pricing attracts long-lived customers or only bargain seekers. Channel-level data can show whether a direct discount steals volume from resellers rather than growing demand.
Still, even rich data should be treated as evidence, not as a substitute for economic reasoning. Artificial intelligence and machine learning can help forecast demand, predict churn, estimate upgrade probability, detect competitor movements, and recommend price changes across large catalogs. The practical reason is straightforward. Modern pricing produces more signals than managers can process manually. But prediction is not the same as strategy. A model can identify patterns in clicks, searches, devices, locations, time of day, or prior purchases.
It does not automatically determine whether the resulting recommendation is economically wise, legally safe, or strategically sustainable. It may optimize for short-run conversion while weakening long-run willingness to pay. It may recommend channel discounts that damage distributor relationships. It may infer that certain customers tolerate high prices without recognizing reputational costs. It may react to rival pricing without understanding whether a competitor's move targets a different segment or is temporary.
Most importantly, it does not decide on its own whether the binding constraint is cost, substitution, brand positioning, or channel control. Economic judgment still sits above the model. The next checkpoint is segmentation. Many markets contain differences in willingness to pay, but not all differences are usable. Economically, a segment matters only if it differs in a way that changes the right price. Operationally, a segment matters only if the firm can identify it, target it, explain it, bill it, and prevent it from leaking across groups. Segmentation can therefore fail for reasons that have nothing to do with economic theory.
It fails when the architecture cannot be implemented, when customers cannot be meaningfully separated, or when the organization cannot administer the complexity without error. So the key question is not whether buyers differ. The question is whether those differences are meaningful and reachable. Enterprise buyers and individual buyers may be meaningfully different. Heavy users and light users may be meaningfully different. Peak period customers and off-peak customers may be meaningfully different. Urgent travelers and flexible travelers may be meaningfully different.
In contrast,
A segmentation idea that requires information the seller does not have, or a level of personalization the organization cannot execute, is not a strategy. It is an analytical fantasy. Before committing to any segmentation plan, the firm must test arbitrage. Arbitrage is the force that tries to erase separation. If low price access can leak into higher price segments, the realized margin collapses toward a single effective price. That leakage can be literal resale of a product. It can also be functional arbitrage, such as routing purchases through a cheaper channel, a different contract, or a different region, and then using the product where a higher price would otherwise apply. If that becomes easy, theoretical willingness to pay differences do not translate into realized margin. Arbitrage is not a side issue after segmentation. It is the test of whether segmentation is real. A lower student price, an off-peak fare, a basic software plan, or a regional discount only works as intended if the low price path is fenced. The fence can be legal, such as a license tied to a named user or organization. It can be technical, such as usage limits, feature restrictions, identity verification, or account controls. It can be contractual or logistical, such as channel restrictions, non-transferability, or packaging differences. The deeper point is simple. Price architecture is only as strong as its weakest fence. Once demand, marginal economics, elasticity, segments, and arbitrage risk are understood, the firm still has one difficult choice. It must select the mechanism. The right mechanism is often not the one that extracts the most value in theory. It is the one that can be implemented cleanly, explained clearly, and defended strategically.
Complexity has a cost. Sales teams misquote, customers become confused, billing systems fail, support burdens rise, channel partners resist, regulators pay closer attention. Internally, managers lose sight of realized price when exceptions, overrides, and promotional layers pile up on top of one another. Uniform pricing illustrates this trade-off. It is easy to dismiss uniform pricing as crude, but in many settings, it remains the best answer. If segmentation opportunities are weak, if arbitrage is easy, if pricing power is limited, or if reputational risk is high, one clear price can outperform a more elaborate design.
In transparent markets, with active comparison and easy switching, fine segmentation may deliver only modest gains. In brands that trade heavily on trust, simplicity and perceived fairness may be worth more than aggressive extraction. In businesses that depend on broad channel cooperation, a uniform policy can reduce conflict and preserve coverage. In categories where the seller has little room to price above the market anyway, the effort spent on elaborate discrimination may not pay for itself. It also helps to revisit dynamic pricing and revenue management through managerial rather than purely conceptual lenses.
Their logic is strongest when inventory, capacity, or timing constraints matter. Airlines and hotels are classic cases because unsold units expire. In e-commerce, capacity logic can still be real when inventory runs tight, replenishment is uncertain, competitor prices move, or the cost of changing a posted price is low. Dynamic repricing then responds to stock levels, search intensity, delivery promises, and rival offers. In subscription businesses, the dynamic element often shifts away from perishable inventory and toward the customer lifecycle.
The relevant questions become, which introductory offer attracts the right type of subscriber? How renewal pricing affects retention, when an upgrade discount lifts lifetime value, and how usage thresholds shape expansion or churn. The principle remains dynamic, but the variable optimized is often revenue over time rather than the sale of a disappearing seat or room.
Subscriptions, usage-based pricing, freemium, and two-part tariffs can also be seen as methods of capturing value across time and across customer types. A subscription monetizes continuing access and works best when value recurs and customers value predictability.
Usage-based pricing ties payment to consumption and tracks heterogeneity more closely when intensity varies substantially. Freemium widens the funnel with a zero or low price entry point and relies on conversion from heavier or higher value users. A two-part tariff combines access and usage, recovering value up front and as consumption unfolds. Each method makes a different bet about how willingness to pay reveals itself over time, and the best choice depends on where heterogeneity sits and how observable it is. Platform pricing extends the same economic reasoning into two-sided markets.
The central choice is often not only what price to charge, but how to divide the price burden across sides. A marketplace may keep participation cheap for buyers to attract traffic for sellers. A payment network may subsidize one side to build volume on the other. An advertising-supported platform may charge advertisers for access to attention while offering monetary free use to consumers. In these settings, one side that appears unprofitable in isolation can still be worth subsidizing if it increases willingness to pay on the other side.
At the same time, platform pricing requires careful judgment about multi-homing, disintermediation, and channel power. If users or sellers can participate on multiple platforms easily, the ability to tax one side is limited. If the platform provides discovery, but transactions happen elsewhere, capture weakens. If regulators view the platform as a gatekeeper, scrutiny follows quickly. Platform pricing is therefore not simply price discrimination in a new costume. It is a structural problem about interdependent demand and interdependent incentives.
As these tools become more sophisticated, the organizational side of pricing becomes more visible. Many pricing failures are not failures of theory. They are failures of coordination. Finance wants margin protection. Sales wants flexibility. Marketing wants attractive entry prices. Operations worries about capacity and service levels. Legal worries about disclosure, competition law, and channel conflict. Product teams want simple packaging. When these groups are misaligned, the result is often a patchwork of discounts, exceptions, and legacy rules that no one fully understands. That is another reason Cost Plus survives.
It gives organizations a shared language, even when that language is economically incomplete. Stronger pricing management therefore requires governance as well as analytics. Someone must define which metrics matter, who can grant exceptions, how experiments are approved, how channel conflict is managed, and when a complex architecture should be simplified. Legal constraints reinforce the need for discipline. Pricing practices can attract antitrust concerns when they exclude rivals, facilitate coordination, or exploit durable market power in ways that harm competition.
The threshold is not whether a price is low or high, because very low prices are not automatically predatory, and very high prices are not automatically unlawful. The risk rises when low prices are used to weaken rivals and may later allow recoupment. Some strategies also face specific rules about how prices are advertised or maintained across channels. Minimum advertised price policies, for example, try to influence how retailers present prices publicly without always dictating the final resale price. Resale price maintenance is treated differently and often depends on the structure of agreements and enforcement.
The legal treatment can vary by jurisdiction, so a pricing architecture that seems routine in one country may face sharper scrutiny elsewhere. Consumer protection rules also differ. Some markets emphasize clear disclosure of fees, renewal terms, and promotional claims. Others place more weight on transparency around automatic renewals or pricing changes. Competitive norms vary as well. Frequent repricing may feel ordinary in one industry and damaging to trust in another. For a global firm, strategy cannot be exported unchanged. It has to account for local law, local channels, and local expectations about fairness and transparency.
All of this brings the discussion back to welfare, which is where the economic analysis began. Every pricing architecture creates winners and losers, and the evaluation depends on the counterfactual. If discriminatory pricing allows a more elastic group to buy at a lower price that a uniform monopoly pricing rule would have excluded, output can rise and deadweight loss can fall, even if the seller captures more surplus overall. If personalized pricing mainly raises prices paid by customers who would have purchased anyway, the primary effect is a transfer from consumer surplus to producer surplus.
If dynamic pricing improves allocative efficiency in a constrained capacity setting, the market may still produce anger among excluded buyers. The central welfare question is always twofold. Does the pricing system change how much trade occurs? And how does it divide the gains from that trade? Deadweight loss appears when buyers who value units above marginal cost do not get sold. Surplus transfer appears when trade still happens, but prices change who keeps the value. Serious strategy distinguishes these effects, rather than treating all price differences as equally harmful or equally beneficial.
That is why the final test of managerial discipline is not moral certainty or pricing cleverness. It is economic coherence under real constraints. A sound pricing decision starts with demand, not with markup. It tests willingness to pay rather than assuming it. It estimates marginal cost and contribution margin before celebrating volume. It treats pricing power as something to be measured through observed response, not declared through intuition. It segments only when differences are economically meaningful and operationally reachable. It anticipates arbitrage and builds fences strong enough to prevent leakage.
And it chooses the simplest mechanism that the firm can execute, explain, and defend strategically, in a way that preserves value creation while controlling the risks of deadweight loss, backlash, and legal exposure. Sources: Khan Academy, Pearson's Monopoly and Deadweight Loss Material, Lumen Learning, and Wikipedia's standard economics entries supplied the baseline microeconomics used throughout, including marginal cost, consumer and producer surplus, price elasticity, market structure, and the link between monopoly pricing and welfare loss.
Wall Street Prep clarified the practical finance vocabulary around contribution margin, markup, and cost-plus pricing, including the difference between a margin percentage and a markup percentage. Simon Kucher's pricing guidance, together with Wikipedia's entries on price discrimination, the Lerner Index, and Ramsey pricing, provided the core rules connecting elasticity, willingness to pay, and market power to optimal pricing and feasible markups.
The University of California, Berkeley paper on versioning information goods anchored the discussion of second-degree price discrimination, self-selection, feature stripping, and the need to prevent arbitrage. The International Air Transport Association, OAG, Precinc, Seven Learnings, and Constellation Energy informed the discussion of airline-style revenue management, dynamic and continuous pricing, demand forecasting, and peak load pricing. Monetizely, NetSuite, Chargebee, and Wikipedia's entry on two-sided markets supplied the material on freemium models, subscription tiers, usage-based billing, network effects,
and platform subsidies.
Intuit, Invesp, PriceShape, Puzzle, and Brex covered value-based pricing, psychological pricing, and anchoring, high-low versus everyday low pricing, skimming, penetration pricing, and loss leader tactics. The Federal Trade Commission, Corporate Compliance Insights, the Rotman School paper on dynamic limit pricing, and the Harvard Business School work on competitive two-part tariffs covered the more defensive and advanced cases, including predatory pricing, minimum advertised price and resale price maintenance policies, entry deterrence, and ways to split fixed and variable charges across customer segments.
This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.